On the way over between Sydney and Singapore, I had an opportunity to read the Tatler, because I was flying with British Airways. Well, I don't see the Tatler otherwise. And I opened the Tatler and found this article, which was a little bit whiny, to be frank. And the whine was really, we have quite a lot of rich people in Britain now, said the article, in a confiding kind of a way. But we're not enjoying our wealth nearly as much as we used to, because unfortunately there's another race of people here who are called the foreign rich, and they're so much richer that we can't really afford to enjoy our richness as we once did. I mean, they're taking our places at the schools, they're buying our houses, they're before us in the queues for the private hospitals, and so on and so on. This was rather a mournful article, so I sat and read it and felt it had a great deal to say, really, about camels passing through the eye of a needle, which is the title of my talk, Threading a Camel Through the Eye of a Needle. Rather more Plato than Prada. And so I was very glad that Don, you know, brought Plato in so immediately. and then about half an hour later, it's a very long flight from Sydney to Singapore. Half an hour later or so, a film was shown which was called Amazing Grace. I don't know whether it's been released here. The filmmaker, it has been released here, hasn't been released at home yet, so it was completely new to me. I had no idea what I was going to see. It was a film made by Mike Apted, who's well known for the 7-Up series, which has got to about many ups now. And it was a film, really, a biopic about William Wilberforce. And reading it while Tatler was still rather too firmly imprinted on... watching this movie while the Tatler article was rather too firmly imprinted on my mind was actually a very sobering thing, because what it showed was how reluctant what were called the ruling classes then, how reluctant the ruling classes were to give up slavery, despite their knowledge of the abominations that the slave trade caused, because it would affect the economy of Britain. And I found myself... the film is quite well made, and I found myself facing the question again, which, you know, we have so many opportunities to face, but this was a very dramatic moment of facing it, of thinking, really, how do we as a society and how do we as individuals think about human life? And what do we really value human life for? What do we value our own lives for? And certainly, what do we value other life for? Can we really buy our comfort at such monstrous expense to other people? I suppose that the ruling classes at that time had what they would have regarded as a very good life, but it came at enormous expense. But the enormous expense, I would like to suggest, wasn't only for those people who suffered outrageously and suffered most, but I think there was also a peculiar kind of suffering for the people who couldn't see others as full human beings, with as much entitlement to the goodness that is in life, the goodness that is in themselves, as anybody else. The whole idea of goodness, the good life, the good person, is much, much easier to talk about as a theory, by the way. When I was thinking about this talk, and I thought about it a lot, I found it a wonderfully provocative topic, and I suspect you have too, as you've been preparing to come here. And I realized that it's so much easier for us to talk about theories of a good life than it is for us to look deeply into life itself and even allow life itself, our experience, the experience of other human beings, the expressions that pass across a person's face, to tell us something about what goodness is, what kindness is, or even what happiness is. So I think we can't really begin to think about the good life as an abstract notion without also thinking about the good person. That's us. That's each one of us. So it's a very grounded topic, this one. It's as grounded as anything could be. The good earth, the good life, goodwill, good humour, a good death. All of those phrases actually resonate in very real ways in our day-by-day existence. It can't be something that's separate from us. It lives in us, or it doesn't live in us. Now, over the years of writing my books, as David mentioned, I've been very concerned in different sorts of ways with different ones of my books as to how we can, what would the best phrase be? How we could most appreciate whatever this life is, and how we could be least dependent, in a sense, on the Prada handbag, on the Belgravia house, or on the feelings of not ever having such things. How can we actually tune in, resist in a way the profound temptations of our time, especially as regards to status, and how we can tune in, honour and privilege what really makes a good life? And there are several ways that I've come at that. One of them is through looking at the spiritual aridity of our times. In parts of Australia, we've had a drought for 5 years, and of course that's very strange for you to be listening to hear about at this time when England is flooded. We've also had some floods. We've had some times of very extreme weather, just as you are. And I think Don is absolutely right to point to the fact that the ecological questions are very urgent now. But the questions of our inner spiritual climate are also very urgent. And to some extent, not the whole picture, but part of the picture of the external climate is how we're using the earth. So we might look at one another and think, what do we value this person for? Or we might look at ourselves and ask the same question. And similarly with the earth. What do we believe the earth is for? How do we believe the earth ought to serve us? Because some of our decisions would be very different if we thought about it in different sorts of ways. Whatever direction we come to thinking about the good life, the personal relationship and the social connections will be very high on the list. Especially if we move our vision of the good life out a little bit so that we're thinking about satisfaction, the feeling of enoughness. And the feeling of enoughness is, of course, a very precious thing, and some people experience very, very little of it. investigations, we make those calculations, we make those judgments constantly. They're part of our human apparatus of thinking. And some of those decisions that we're making about whether this is enough or whether this is good or whether this is bad or whether this is ideal or whether this is perfect or whether this is sufficient, some of those decisions that we make are very unconscious. They're just very habitual. They're very socially conditioned. And one of the things that we have a great opportunity to do is to wake up and make more of those choices a little bit more consciously, so that we can bring alive a greater potential to be living something that feels satisfying for us and more deeply connects us with what we most value, which is at least part of a definition of a good life. And so, of course, that takes us to questions of meaning. And I think questions of meaning have probably come up at every single one of your Sea of Faith conferences. Because in a sense, and particularly when we're thinking about the good life, the meaning out of which our judgments grow, the soil out of which our judgments grow, the soil out of which our criticisms grow, the soil out of which our gratitude grows, is very much coloured and shaped by the kind of meaning that we give to our own existence. So this is an ethical question, this is a spiritual question, it's a psychological one, and it's very much a social question too. And when I was thinking about the kinds of examples I could bring for this, I thought very much and very immediately, of course, about Viktor Frankl, because Man's Search for Meaning has been a key book for me. It's been one of those books that I've returned to every 2 or 3 years, not just to reabsorb Frankl's wisdom, but also in a sense to measure my own progress, my own maturing, which is a lifelong journey. But it wasn't one of the stories from Man's Search for Meaning that I wanted to bring so much today, because the insights in that book, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book if any of you have yet to have the great pleasure of reading it. But there he's talking about the human capacity to, in a sense, sustain kindness. The meaning, to sustain meaning through kindness, even in the most dire situation. And most of us will never be in such a dire situation. So that example sits slightly outside our everyday frame of reference. And we're probably a little bit inclined to think, well, that was all right for those wonderful people, but, you know, we know our own insufficiencies all too well. Would my goodness extend that far? Would my goodness withstand the very extreme badness that was all around those people at that time? So it's another story that I wanted to bring to you from Viktor Frankl. And it's a story about his coming from his psychoanalytic practice that he established long time after the war. And an old man came to see him one day and said to him, "Dr. Frankl, my wife has been dead for some time, and I cannot shift my grief. It's with me when I wake up in the morning. I go to sleep with it at night, and I eat it for lunch." And Dr. Frankl asked him to tell the story of his marriage and of his wife and of his loss. And the old man did that. And at the end of a very sustained period of listening, Dr. Frankl asked him, "Tell me, how would your wife have coped had you died first?" And the man said, "Oh, she wouldn't have coped at all. It would have been terrible for her. Oh, dreadful for her. I can feel the grief of that right away." And Viktor Frankl said, "You saved her that." Now that's a very powerful and beautiful story. Not because the facts were changed, not because the man's grief would cease, but because his inner relationship to his own grief was changed by that miraculous kindness. He was able to see how the great love that had sustained him in his marriage had also and could also sustain him in his grief. I want to give you another tiny little example about choice and meaning. And I have to say, I wrote this when I was in Sydney, and I wrote it with a little bit of a smile because I know that cues are a bit of a feature of English life. I did live here for 16 years, so I got to know the English cue. So here's the scenario. You're standing in a queue, and it's moving very, very slowly, and you are really irritated. In fact, what you're telling yourself is that every time you join the queue, the queue slows. You're really taking it upon yourself that your joining the queue has slowed the queue. And as this queue fails to move forward, you become more and more and more enraged. But unfortunately, despite the fervor of your rage, the queue moves no more quickly. Or, on the other hand, you could be standing in the same queue and you recognize that it's moving rather slowly, and so you decide to meditate. Or you're planning your holiday in the Algarve, or you phone a friend, and the queue moves no more slowly. So this again is a question not so much of meaning, but of attitude. When you reach the head of that queue, of course, how you react to the person you're meeting, how you even react through the rest of your day, will be very significantly shifted by the inner impulses you brought to that trivial, banal, everyday little moment. Whether your day was good or whether your day was not good would largely be determined by something as trivial as your attitude towards one of those inevitable inconveniences of life. So I'm talking here about freedom, and I'm talking here about choice. There's another little story that I want to tell, which comes from Matthew's Gospel, a good source of stories I have found. Jews in the time of Christ had to carry the bag of a Roman for a mile if they were requested to do so. And those of you who know your Bible, and I suspect many of you do, know that in Matthew 5:41, they're told that they have the freedom to carry the bag also for a second mile. And this is something that I've written about a great deal, because it's not at all an exercise in masochism. It's an exercise in freedom. That there are so many things that we have to do, and we can bring a certain kind of attitude towards them, and then there are other things that we can choose to do because we can. And why is this important? Well, it's important for an incredibly simple reason, which is that when our lives are dictated by events outside ourselves, and that's how it is for most people, most of us think that a good life is something that happens to us. But as long as we think a good life is something outside there, over which we have relatively little control, we will feel extremely vulnerable. Or, alternatively, as long as we feel relatively confident that we can meet situations as they arise with something that might be called resilience or good humour or serenity or wisdom or peace of mind, then many situations are not going to throw us off our perch. Some situations will, of course, still grieve us deeply. I'm in no way suggesting that a good life is a kind of plateau, that we never have a valley again and that we never have a peak. On the contrary, I would say. But you know, many of the valleys, even some of the abysses, are actually so trivial they weren't worth the fall. And why were they trivial? Oh, why were they felt so deeply, those trivial events? Often because we are giving too much weight to what happens outside ourselves and too little consideration to those inner choices that we can make. But the inner choices, of course, don't stop with us. We make those inner choices, and then the effect of them radiates out onto other people. I really want to emphasize that. So that the good life is not just about feeling greater peace of mind, more resilient, better humoured, and even kinder and more compassionate. That's a part of the story. The other part of the story is, how are you affecting other people? Back to the William Wilberforce and Tatler. How are you affecting other people? Through the way that you behave in small matters and large, and the way you think about them. And none of this is new, of course. Epictetus, I've just got this lovely example, had this to say: the essence of philosophy is that a man or woman, I don't think he said a woman, but I popped it in, should so live that his or her happiness shall depend as little as possible on external things. And also this: human beings are not disturbed by events or things, but by the view they take of them. I think self-help's been around a long time. And finally this: a vulgar man, in any ill that happens to him, blames others. A novice in philosophy blames himself. A true philosopher blames neither the one nor the other, but gets on with it. So, I'm moving towards the camel, by the way, a little bit slowly. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about money before bringing the camel into the room. When I left the United Kingdom in 1983 to go and live in Sydney, I had a little house in Bow, quite a nice little house actually, even with a little garden, and I sold it for £35,000. Ah, that's probably a call from the real estate agent offering me a better sum. 24 years later, on 1st of July 2007, I got this from the internet, the Times reported that the average price of a new home in London is now £385,686. More generally, the average price of a house in England and Wales in March of this year was £178,423, although if you need your house to be detached, you would have to find £270,426. So all those people who didn't get themselves together to buy a house before they went to kindergarten are going to miss out, I gather. But we have to ask, are the asset rich happier than they used to be? In Australia, 40% of women who have a baby will be back in full-time work before the baby is one. One man in five in most Western countries will spend more time commuting than with his children. Japanese men, and I suspect Australian and British men, who work 11 hours a day are 2.5 times more likely to have a heart attack than those who work 8 hours a day. And in Australia, I don't know about Britain, in Australia almost no one who works 8 hours a day. Oh, so we're moving towards money. In the lands of plenty, we have a highly developed ethic of work, and we have a very poorly developed ethic of care. We have a very poorly developed ethic of care towards ourselves, other than sometimes treating ourselves like babies. And we have a very poorly developed ethic of care towards other people. Which takes me to the camel, very patiently waiting. And I want you now to imagine that this room is not a room but a tent, billowing away. And I am bringing a camel into this room. And you, by the way, are holding in your hand a needle. And using the tremendous power that is your human imagination, I want you to imagine that you are threading the one through the other, the bigger through the smaller, by the way. The camel is, of course, humpy and has very, very bad breath. And it's disinclined to cooperate with party tricks. The needle is very small, and you have forgotten your glasses. So, will you succeed? So, Christian churchgoers, past and present, know the old camel and needle trick, and also the trick of finding a text and jumping off from it, which I have to say I don't much use in my services, but it's very nice to do it today. So, what does this story tell us? Well, the first thing that it tells us is the power of the human mind. Did some of you at least imagine a camel? Did some of you at least imagine the needle? Did some of you at least imagine not having your glasses at the moment at which you needed them? So the human mind is this blazing mix of the conscious, the unconscious, the known and the unknown, and it loves tricks. In fact, one of the things that detracts from a good life and detracts from happiness is not giving our minds enough to think about. An understimulated mind, an under-challenged mind, is as liable to stress as an overly challenged mind. So psychologists who do a great deal of good service in their research report that each of us has about 50,000 thoughts a day. That's some of what's going on in your mind. You're having 50,000 thoughts a day, and on a bad day you're having one thought 50,000 times. Is that right? It's sort of like the sushi train. Do you have sushi trains here? You know, it's always the tuna. Do you have those trains that come round and round with the sushi? Yeah. So on a better day, when our thoughts are a little bit more varied, we can recognize how far we go, how far and how easily we often go from anything we could remotely call reality. A very vast proportion of our thinking is driven by projections, assumptions, habits. Not very much of it is fresh and in this moment. And yet one of the most simple and sustaining discoveries to be made about happiness, for example, is that it can only be experienced in the present moment. So getting a little bit of a grip on what thought does is a really very good thing. And getting a little bit of a grip on what imagination does is a very good thing. There's a lovely passage from the Dhammapada, the great Buddhist scripture, which goes, "With our thoughts we create the world." And of course, "with our thoughts we create the world" was echoed by John Milton in Paradise Lost. "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven." But the Dhammapada goes on and in a very interesting way. "What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind." In other words, our thoughts are our powerhouse. We ignore them, or we take them for granted, or we assume their naturalness, in a sense, at our peril. "If someone acts with a fearful mind, suffering follows as the wheel of the cart follows the beast that draws the cart. Many do not know that we're here in this world to live in harmony." There's a thought. We are here in this world to live in harmony, which doesn't mean that we won't have difference. It means that we would deal with difference intelligently, and would not resort to violence. That we would even welcome difference and love it. "Those who know this do not fight against each other," says the Dhammapada. "Even as rain breaks through a poorly thatched house, dangerous emotions will break through a poorly guarded mind." That is, a mind in which we let anything arise and run after it, regardless of whether it's worth running after or not. So, as long as we are on this earth, this beautiful earth, each of us will need a sense of belonging. I think that's right. A sharing in the earth's wondrous beauty. A need for aesthetic pleasures, for sensual pleasures, the sharing of stories, and most urgently of all, the giving and the receiving of love. We also need some highly practical things. Food to eat, a good night's sleep. Life is not good when you haven't had a good night's sleep. Safety and clean air. A few weeks ago in Sydney, I spoke at a conference where the Dalai Lama was speaking. And he's very straightforward when it comes to happiness and the good life. He says, "There is an inextricable link between one's personal happiness and kindness. And this link is reciprocal. cultivating a, this is my commentary now, cultivating a kinder, more good-humoured, less rigid attitude to life measurably increases your emotional well-being and also your physical health. Your physical health is, of course, dependent on a number of factors, but your sense of well-being is one of the most powerful of those factors. Even better, His Holiness echoes Epictetus when he says, "Happiness is determined more by the state of one's mind than by one's external circumstances," which takes us back to the camel and to English house prices. Because the second gift that emerges from this story, the first gift being, what are we doing with our minds? What are we doing with our gift of imagination? What are we doing with our thoughts? How are our thoughts being expressed out there? Do I see you as an economic unit, or do I see you as a human being? These are important questions. But the second gift that emerges is one about clinging. It's a very wonderful lesson. We live in a world of things, and we have opinions about those things, and we imbue those things with certain values. Experience tells us otherwise, but even if we regard ourselves as relatively unmaterialistic and certainly not greedy, we often think that one more thing will do it. One more course, one more degree, one more lover, one more house, one more car, one more yacht, one more Prada handbag. They are sometimes the source of happiness, and pleasure is certainly one kind of happiness, and no one wants to knock it. Pleasure, appreciation, gratitude. But sometimes the pleasure and appreciation and gratitude don't last very long. So, in our society, you don't need me to come from Australia to tell you this, pleasure seeking is rapidly increasing. There's a kind of fervour to it. Sometimes an obsessive flavour or an addictive flavour to the pleasure seeking that is very, very extreme and very much a mark of these times. But what the psychologists call positive functioning may in fact be diminishing, and positive functioning only means treating other people well. Walking lightly on this earth, as George Fox said, answering that of God in everyone. That's a very specific kind of pleasure. There are lots of work being done by economists, and it will be there'll be much more about it in this paper when you eventually read it. But the economists are now jumping in also on this happiness topic. And in the period of 2000 to 2006, the science of happiness for economists was placed just at half the level of interest in wages and just below that of discrimination, although happiness is catching up. And why? Because happiness, or particularly the absence of happiness, is actually costing our boundlessly rich Western civilization so much. In 1996, the World Health Organization identified depression as among the top five conditions affecting reduced life expectation. But by 2020, depression is predicted to be the most serious illness globally. In other words, forget the bird flu. Oh, you could have put the bird flu on there, Don. We're very excited about the bird flu in Asia and Australia. So here we... Oh, it is on? Oh, well, okay, well, forget it. In fact, it's going to be the absence of happiness. Now, again, you know, depression is a multifactorial illness. I'm not suggesting that it's just met by a better attitude, a greater depth of meaning, treating oneself a little more kindly, and so on and so on. But this is one of the factors. One of the factors individually, certainly, but undoubtedly it's one of the factors when we think about happiness as a social value, or when we think about kindness or collectivity or inclusion rather than exclusion as a social value. Now, The next exciting thing that the economists and the psychologists have told us is that while money can buy us some wonderful experiences, our happiness set point won't be very much affected by it. Do you have lotto here? You know, when you win really a lot of money. Really, such a lot of money. Well, even if you win lotto, or even if you win the heart of another, and fall madly in love, your happiness set point won't change for very long. We really are very subject to the temptations to thinking that if we had a little more, we would definitely be a little happier, and if we had a lot more, we'd be a lot happier. Even though we see the evidence every day or every week in Hello magazine, that this is not the case. However, this happiness set point depends 50% on genes. So quickly think, how happy were your parents? So 50% on your genes, 15% on social circumstances, and the rest is up to you. So that leaves quite a big margin. And the only thing that changes your happiness set point, and therefore your vision of a good life, and your willingness to be a source of good life for others, your greatest freedom of all, to be a source of happiness and the good life for others, the only thing that will make a significant change is an internal change in attitude. So that shift may even reflect the kind of religious expression that Don Cooper describes as, this is from The Way to Happiness, Don, a universal, non-fixated love for life, for our world, and for one's fellow human, so passionate that one should, to use Don's word, burn. Isn't that wonderful? I wrote down here, agape or metta with a beat, Don. So, and that calls for change from the inside out. From the inside out. It's not going to be achieved by what we bring into our lives, which may be utterly delightful, gorgeous, well-deserved, but it's not going to make that inner change for us. The only thing that will make the inner change is a shift in attitude. I would say a shift towards a greater and much more inclusive experience of love for life, for fellow humans with all their faults and shortcomings, for ourselves with all our faults and shortcomings, which takes us rather neatly back to the camel and the needle. I don't think that story is saying anything at all about rich people and heaven, even if you believe in heaven and even if you are rich people. I think it's asking us to notice what we cling to. Notice what we pay attention to. Notice what we're investing in terms of our hopes, our passions, our awareness. The person who has a great deal may be more easily distracted. I think that's all that story is telling us. Now, I've only got a few moments left. I hope I have got a few moments left, have I? Because I want to speak very, very briefly about Plato. So I'm embarrassed, of course, to do it in front of Don, but I'm going to turn my back very slightly. Actually, I can only simplify absurdly, so let me try. Plato argued, of course, for the idea of the good. And last year, when I had to speak in Sydney on a topic which was called God Creator or Created, I spoke about Rudolf Otto's book, The Idea of the Holy. So it was a little bit nice to think about the idea of the good this time, which is the conscious cultivation of harmony, ethical living, and justice, and a response to beauty that in its highest form not only has possibly its independent external being, but also its reflection in our souls, or at the very least, if that word isn't one for you, in our lives. So beyond good actions is a state of being good, which has nothing to do with the feared and despised goody-goodness. But Plato also urged contemplation, as Don said, of the eternal, beautiful, and good. And I would really disagree with him, not so that we are no longer observing this life and just mesmerized by that object of love, or that focus for love, which I think is a more accurate word than object. On the contrary, so that we can draw from it and emanate those qualities within our own lives. In my own search for meaning, the grim Father God is long gone. The contemplation of the eternal, beautiful and good is very, very real for me. Concerning these things, wrote Plato, there is not, nor will there be, any treatise written by me, for they do not at all admit of being expounded in writing, as do objects of other studies. So now we are actually moving the camel through the eye of a needle. We are doing the impossible. Only after long, arduous conversance with the matter itself, a light suddenly breaks upon the soul as from a kindled flame, and once born keeps alive of itself. Which means that once we've understood something that has a quality that we might loosely call transcendent, we don't go back. That's the difference between transformation and change. Transformed, we don't go back. So my vision of a good life extends to, ignites and unites all layers of my being, mind, heart, body, spirit and soul. It's finite and it's infinite, it's familiar, and I am happy that it is also deeply mysterious. A good life, I hope I've shown this a little bit, can't be bought and sold, just as you can't be bought and sold. A good life isn't something I have to deserve. A good life is, and I am. Thinking about the good life, I remembered these wonderful lines from Raymond Carver. And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. For me, the highest form of goodness is love. We reach through love towards love, and not through the intellect only. Love in all its forms demands from us the courage to surrender. In the good life, for me, that surrender is called as well as willed. It's the lover of the divine surrendering to the love from the divine, and meaning is transformed. Love is the connection. Love is my source, infinite and mysterious, and I am, and you are, as each form of love is, life is, love's expression. So two very tiny stories to finish with. A few years ago, I was in Ahmedabad in Gujarat, in India, and I visited the ashram of Mahatma Gandhi. And I was so delighted by how humble and non-Disney that ashram is. It's very, very touching, dusty, slow-moving, run-down. And I was so struck by a very large blow-up in the handwriting of Mahatma Gandhi, of that famous and profound phrase, "My life is my message." Life, good or bad, is not a theory. It's a living. The other story is one that I tell in my book, Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love. And for me, it encapsulates everything that I've been trying to say. There were three stone cutters, all employed on the building of a cathedral in medieval times. When the first one was asked what he was doing, he responded very impatiently, angrily even, "As you can see, I am cutting stones." And then the second one was asked, "What are you doing?" The man replied, "I'm earning a living for my family," which is a very honourable thing to do. And then the third one was asked the same question. We can imagine that it was a very hot day in Italy. People didn't have much choice about what they were doing. The work was hard and people didn't live so long. And this man put down his tools and stood up to answer this question. "What are you doing?" He stood up and said, "I am building a great cathedral." Thank you for your time.